Welcome back to the Power Hour. I am so jazzed that we have Catherine. And I think your information, I don't know if you knew this, Catherine, if for some reason we're going to get you, I was literally going to play your interview on Planet Lockdown. That's how important this information is. That's all I was going to do, is just play your interview that people get exposed to this. Uh-huh. Catherine Austin Fitz, easy for me to say, of course, is the founder and director of the Solari Report. Fantastic information. Her and Dr. Skidmore figured out this black money going on. She was secretary under Housing and Urban Development. She's been on the highest levels of Wall Street. She is somebody who demands respect. Her opinion matters. Her voice is seminal, and I've never heard anybody that can put everything together like her. We're so honored to have her here today. Catherine, welcome back to the Power Hour.
Oh, it's great to be back. You know, and I give a little nod in my spirit to Joyce.
Yes, we all do, don't we?
Yeah, I know. She was a great woman.
We all do. Your interview, Planet Lockdown, has been banned by Facebook. It's been banned by YouTube, like a lot of other things out there. I've listened. I haven't watched all of it. I've watched some of it. It's stunning in its scope and its calm nature, way it lays this out. I think the way you do this is unbelievable. Let's go back. Give us a background, maybe 20 years ago when globalization really started to accelerate in this country. What are we looking at 25 years ago that led us up to now, and then what are we looking at today?
So we were watching two things, and it really helps to understand what happened then, because it's what we're watching is sort of the culmination of that process. And there are two sources that I would recommend. One is I have an online book called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. And every time I try to publish in a hard copy, I get threatened. Or somebody
really?
Gets threatened. And so, yeah. So I just leave it online. You know, I figure it's not suppressed. And there's a ton of documentation and research behind it. So everything's very carefully backed up.
What is that name?
One more time
with that name.
Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. And what it documents is the fact that they knew that they were moving significant amounts of personal income abroad, and that when they levered everybody up with the mortgage debt, they knew that they couldn't afford it. And I would describe that as fraudulent inducement, and it sort of explains why I believe most mortgages during that period under the law, if the law was fairly applied, would have been determined to be fraudulently induced. Anyway, it explains that. The other thing, which is absolutely outstanding, and if you haven't watched it, Sir James Goldsmith, who's one of the great leaders, in my opinion, of the last 30 years, came to America before Congress adopted the Uruguay round of GATT that instituted the World Trade Organization. And he did an interview with Charlie Rose, and he explained why what we were about to do would devastate the Western economies and wipe out the middle class. And if you read the Dylan Reed book and you listen to Sir James Goldsmith, which to this day is the most brilliant, concise, succinct, accurate description I've ever seen of sort of what's happening with our economic models and globalization, what you will understand is the American leadership knew exactly what they were doing, and they knew what the ramifications would be. And what I describe in the Dylan Reed book is that there was great frustration in the leadership over the inability to broker a balanced budget deal in 1995, and literally one of the largest pension fund presidents in the country said this to me, and I quoted verbatim in Dylan Reed. He said, they've given up on the country. They've decided to move all the money out starting in the fall. And that was the fall, that was the beginning of fiscal 1998, when $21 trillion started to go missing between fiscal 1998 and fiscal 2015. There have been new reports of significantly more going missing. The problem is in 2018, under, you know, as a bipartisan deal between the Senate, the House, and the White House, the government decided to adopt a policy that says, oh, we can keep secret books. And so from the minute that happened, it happened in the middle of the Kavanaugh hearings. You know, they always sneak the important things through. when the media is talking about sex. So when they snuck the secret books authorization called FASB Statement 56 or Standard 56, from then on, the books of the U.S. government became entirely meaningless. I just did another interview with Dr. Mark Skidmore, who is the wonderful professor from Michigan who, upon hearing me describe 6.5 trillion going missing from DOD and in 2015 said, no, they can't possibly be. So he went to the DOD financial statements and discovered, yes, I was absolutely right. It was sourced from a government document. He called me and he said, what can I do to help? And I said, let's do, he had students who would help. And I said, let's do a complete survey of HUD and DOD. And at that point, you're going to laugh. I had the missing money up to $12 trillion. And he kept finding more. You know, when I get these calls, he'd say, oh, my God, we found another trillion. Oh, my God. And he got it all the way up to $21 trillion. So at this point, unfortunately, the U.S. financial statements, as well as probably the financial statements of the contractors and banks that do business, serious amounts of business with the U.S. government are, unfortunately, you know, it's hard to know what they mean.
Are they dark?
It's not a wonderful situation.
Are they so, you know, confused, or are they dark completely so you don't know?
So I would say this way, and I'd go back to what I said in the earlier to you. I think a decision was made in 1995 that you couldn't get the general population to support a financially responsible solution. And the amount of money that was going into the black budget that had hit the system of finance was growing, growing, growing. And there, it was impossible to run a global empire, you know, with significant and growing amounts of secrecy, not just about the money, but about technology and weaponry, with a population who had progressively become less and less clear about, you know, their map of the world had become so shrunk that they couldn't contemplate what the risk issues are. So, for example, if you read, we have a, you know, every quarter at the Salih Report, we do a wrap-up, and we've done several on space. And I explain in those why I come to the conclusion that one of the reasons that they decided to globalize when they did was they needed to create the capacity to build a multiplanetary civilization, and that was a major strategic goal. And, of course, it makes more sense to people now because you're seeing tremendous, you know, commitment and discussion of space, both by the public and the private sector. And if you look at the contribution that's being made to the effort in space, clearly Asia and the Asian space programs are making a very serious and significant contribution that would never have happened if we hadn't globalized. So if you're the leadership and you're trying to, you know, think in 100-year increments, it's hard to get people in a democratic process to support you, particularly when the media is engaged in significant, I would describe as babyfication of the population. And, you know, news is moving away from news to entertainment and sort of dumbing down. You know, and so the population gets further and further from sharing a map. And what we've seen, and I think part of this is all the money behind the secrecy, what we've seen is literally people break away and start, in essence, their own civilization. And part of this was, you know, the reason I think there was a financial coup, which is we have $21 trillion disappearing until 2015, more now, although it's hard to know what the numbers mean. We had $24 to $29 trillion disappear on the bailouts, and I would suggest that there are probably some others. But let's just say for around number 50, we bubbled the economy with massive amounts of government debt, and then we shifted the $50 trillion out into this, you know, into the offshore havens or into space or into investing in underground bases or, you know, whatever you're doing behind the secrecy and black budget. And then we've left the liabilities in the entity. So we've taken the assets, except for the real estate, and we've left the liabilities. And I'm grossly oversimplifying to make the point. You know, and the question is, at the end game, now that they've sucked out all the assets by bubbling, what you've got left are the retirement liabilities and the debt. And so the question is, how do you consolidate that financial coup? And the way you do it is you blame the victim, because the last thing you want is everybody in your audience listening and saying, well, wait a minute. You know, you owe us, you or the contractors who did the illegal transactions, the banks that did the illegal transactions, you owe us the $21 trillion, and looking at this $24 to $29 trillion on the balance, you probably owe us that too. We're going to assert a right of offset, and we're going to grab those assets, or, you know, we're going to have a real conversation about where the liability is. Instead, you say, oh, my God, you're all domestic extremists, you're domestic terrorists, you're white national supremacists. We need to attack you.
Very convenient.
We're in a bit of a dance between, you know, the folks who've been in charge of this and are legally accountable and liable, and the people who are just about to wake up and discover that there's a, you know, that all the promises that they've been made have been, you know, the Treasury's been emptied out. Now, you know, I'm going to be the bad guy here. So there's a group of us who've been trying to explain this for the last 25 years. Most people don't want to know. They don't want to hear. And so, you know, to a certain extent, we've all been complicit. Now, I think I've told my red button story on the Power Hour.
I love that story. I want you to tell it again. Before you transition, let me go back to what you said, a question at the beginning. I have to ask this before it gets away from us. You mentioned that they've given up on America. You kind of answered it. I have to know for the story. Why?
I don't think they've given up on America. I think they gave up on trying to manage the global empire within the mechanisms of the existing domestic federal government.
I see.
In other words,
so basically, the clunkiness of our republic, the clunkiness of our, actually voting and actually making decisions, and forget that, we'll just go and do our own thing. That's basically what you're saying.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I can't stress to you how difficult it was to manage the political mechanism. And part of it was, you know, because I worked in Washington in a senior appointment. You know, everybody comes to Washington and they just want more money for their thing. There's no culture in the body politic to take responsibility for the whole. And it becomes, when you're in there, it becomes increasingly frustrated. And the corruption has gotten worse, worse, worse. And it's part of the way you deal with that kind of corruption is with transparency, but you can't use transparency because of all the secrecy. So it's funny. I used to have a pastor in Washington who would scream when he got a bee in his bonnet about something. He'd scream, God does not bless a mess. And if you look at the federal credit mechanism, these guys have figured out a way to basically generate, you know, a couple $100 trillion and probably steal a lot of it. But at the same time, if you look at what is left, it's a mess. And I'll never forget when in 1989, it's long story short, when I decided to go serve as the federal housing commissioner, I talked to the guy who run our firm was the secretary of the treasury, and I told him I was going to do it. And he just completely flipped, and he said, I mean, almost losing his temper, he said, you can't go to HUD as a sewer. And that's because you had so much of this covert, you know, you had so much of this covert stuff going on.
Did everybody know it? Like Wall Street, was this just like, oh, we already know this. I mean, everybody, this is common knowledge.
But here's the funny thing. I never believed. People would try and tell me. So I was assistant secretary, and then I left, and I started a firm that ended up winning on competitive bids, serving as the lead financial advisor. And people had tried to warn me about the financial fraud. I did not believe the mortgage fraud was anywhere near as bad as people tried to warn me that it was. And then when I got, you know, what happened was the Department of Justice basically seized our offices and stole our software, which was going to bring transparency to all the mortgages in the country, including the fact that there were many more mortgages than there were houses. It was part of the problem. And so when they flipped out and seized the software and stole it, you know, then I said, okay, I got to look deeper and figure out what's going on. It took me many years to figure out how, not only how bad the mortgage fraud was, but to figure out how it could have been going on and me not know. I mean, I think that's the hard thing for a lot of Americans. They just can't fathom that the world got this far apart from their reality without them realizing it. So I had to go through that process of, you know, proving to myself, and I was lucky because I was dealing with something that lends itself to mathematics. You know, I turn everything into, you know, mapping with mathematics of time and money, so that helped. But I'll never forget in 2001, I went to visit with the chief of staff to the senator who ran the committee that appropriated the money for HUD and a whole slew of other agencies, including Treasury. And they looked at me and they said, what do you think is going on at HUD? And it was a person, I knew the senator, but I didn't know the chief of staff. Very smart person. And I said, I was trying to be polite. I said, I don't know, what do you think is going on? And they looked me dead in the eye and said, HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise. And I looked at them, and that's when it finally snapped for me after many years of researching and investigating. And I said, I don't disagree. Because if you look at how HUD was being run by the New York Fed member banks, by the Treasury, by the Department of Justice, and by the big defense contractors, it was being run as a criminal enterprise, potentially. That's why when, you know, whenever they settle with one of the banks over, you know, unbelievable, like the mortgage fraud, you know, I just call that a kickback. Because you can't do these things without the federal government helping you. There's no way you can do that kind of mortgage fraud without a, what some people would call a public-private partnership, is what it's always looked like to me. But, you know, so here I was. I've been a partner at a Wall Street firm, a member of the board of directors. I had been the FHA commissioner, and then I've been a lead financial advisor. And I hadn't faced how bad it was because I couldn't figure out how much fraud could just be done through the IT systems without a lot of people on the line of management knowing. You know, a lot of it, the more we integrate digital technology, the more you do this amazing kind of financial fraud.
Your red button story, have to hear it.
Okay, so this was never have a big epiphany in the middle of a speech. That's what happened to me. I had a wonderful friend who asked me to give a speech at a group called Spiritual Frontiers Foundation, international, very sophisticated, nice people who have a conference about how they can help our society evolve spiritually. And she had asked me to give a presentation, which later became a very famous article, got translated into many languages, called Narco Dollars for Beginners. And it was meant to be a light, funny explanation of the intersection between narcotics trafficking and other illegal money, essentially money laundering, and Washington and Wall Street, sort of how the economics works. And I took it from a little street corner in West Philadelphia where I grew up all the way to Wall Street in Washington. You could kind of see the kickback system. You can also see that in the Dylan Reed and story, and you can, it's easy to pick up on a search online. Anyway, so I'm giving this speech called How the Money Works on Organized Crime. And I'm in the middle of speech, and I'm describing the fact that the Congress had held testimony in 1998 related to the Dark Alliance allegations that are so famous. Gary Webb wrote the book Dark Alliance. And it's basically about U.S. intelligence agencies laundering narcotics, or bringing narcotics in and then laundering them probably with mortgages. Anyway, so a reporter that I was working with, a really top-notch investigative reporter in Washington, spoke to the Department of Justice spokesperson about questions she had during that testimony. And the Department of Justice spokesperson told the reporter that the U.S. economy launders $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of all illegal monies. So that's narcotics trafficking, that's illegal gambling, it's, you know, everything. So I said to this wonderful group of spiritually evolved people, what would happen if we stopped being the global leader in money laundering? And there was a little conversation. They said, well, that money would go to Zurich in Hong Kong instead of the New York Stock Exchange. And, you know, they wouldn't buy government bonds, so our taxes might go up or our government checks might stop. I said, okay, you know, and if the money went to left the New York Stock Exchange, then our IRAs would go down in value, our 401k. So I said, okay, let's pretend there's a big red button up on this lectern, and if you push that button, you can stop all hard narcotics trafficking in your city, your county, your town, thus offending the people who control $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of money laundering and the accumulated capital thereon. Who here will push the button? And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, not one would push the button. I was stunned. I was floored. I had no idea. So I said, well, why would you not push the button? One guy would push the button. So the other 99 said, we don't want our government checks to stop. We don't want our taxes to go up. And we don't want our IRAs and 401ks to go down in value. And in fact, there's a great folk singer from Texas who wrote a song about this called Narco Dollars. And so I said, what I discovered in the conversation was not that they wouldn't push the red button. The problem was that they wouldn't go into the invention room and talk about, okay, how can we figure out how to make money pushing the red button? I call it turning the red button green. And how can we, because all you're doing is you're liquidating your society. You know, basic, because I think to them what you're saying is you want the American intelligence and enforcement agencies to bring narcotics in and sell them to the kids in your neighborhood so that you can keep making money in your IRA. Is that really what you're saying?
That is what they're saying, isn't it?
Well, here's the thing. If over time since then, every year, my guess is that audience, more people would push the red button because they realize, you know, this is not something that's 2 degrees of separation away from me. You know, we have now reached the point where we've built a machinery that's making money from liquidating all of us.
Hold on 1 second. There's a music, Todd. Do you need a break, Catherine, or can we just go? Do you need a break? Are you okay?
No. Let's just soar through.
Todd, let's just get rid of the break. Is that okay? Okay, let's get rid of the break. Let's go through Catherine. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Catherine. Continue.
That's okay. Anyway, so you know, one of the things that really gets me very frustrated, I said to a very knowledgeable financial person the other day, how many of the people who went to the rally on January 6th had credit cards in their pocket or bank cards from one of the New York member banks, you know, that basically own the New York Fed and whose owners are driving the going direct reset, which is basically what is going on now. This is the going direct reset, and the central bankers voted and approved on it on August 22nd, 2019, and it's been happening ever since, and that's what we're in the middle of. And I said, how many of those people in that rally do you guess had, you know, money and are financing the New York Fed member banks who are doing all of this? And they said probably 70%. And I said, well, instead of spending all that money, going all that way to Washington, what if they just canceled their bank account and credit card at J.P. Morgan Chase? They said, could be a revolution.
Wow.
So, you know,
they've got
here's
a lot
the
more
funny
done.
Thing, because they keep absolutely. You know, here's the thing. We cannot keep making money financing the prison and then expect some person like the Lone Ranger to run for president and fix it when we won't stop building it ourselves. Do you know what I mean? Everybody's going to work and making money destroying the country or, you know, or financing destroying the country. If you look at who is doing this, we're financing it. We're the employee. We're the customer. We're the bank depositor. We're the, you know, I can't tell you how many people after the financial fraud. So let me give you one of my favorite stories. A couple of quarters ago, we did a great wrap-up called Can ESG Turn the Red Button Green? And we used J.P. Morgan Chase as an example, and we have an insert that shows you every settlement we could find for the last, since 2006, for settlements with enforcers and regulators for civil and criminal violations by J.P. Morgan Chase, totaling $42 billion is what we could find, which is more than their annual income. Anyway, so you look at the list and you just look at it and say, how can this not be a criminal enterprise? And the federal government that would be complicit and make money on it not be a criminal enterprise anyway. So let me go back and I'll tell you my favorite J.P. Morgan Chase story. So you remember the Madoff Ponzi scheme, right?
Sure, yeah.
Right. Okay, so after the Madoff went down, one of the people who lost her money or lost a great deal of money in Madoff was a wonderful New York attorney named Helen Chapman, who ended up representing a lot of the different people who'd lost money and had really converted it into part of her important part of her legal practice. She's a brilliant, brilliant New York attorney, and she wrote a book called J.P. Madoff, and I had her on the Slater Report, and I'm in the middle of it, and so we're talking about Madoff's money management business. He had a brokerage business. He had a money management business. Did, I think, about $60 billion in the money management business. So Helen is explaining to me how it works, and she said, well, Madoff only had one bank account for his investment advisory business. The business was $60 billion, the Ponzi scheme, and that one bank account was at J.P. Morgan Chase. And so I said to her, Helen, who was the securities custodian? And she said, there was none, because he never bought any securities, which meant
that's nice.
J.P. Morgan Chase knew everything, everything. And I said to her, Helen, J.P. Morgan Chase was the senior partner. It was their fraud. They controlled.
Wow.
Because
oh my God.
All the money came in, and then it went out, but it never went to a securities custodian. There was never any purchase of securities, and they knew. Right? Now, let me ask you something. Given that fact came out in, I don't know, 2007, 2008, why, according to Helen, at that point, 50% of Americans banked with J.P. Morgan Chase. They had a credit card, or they had, you know, a credit card from somebody that was. Why? What is it we don't understand about not playing with matches?
Wow. Have you heard? I'm sure you have. Have you heard about this silver squeeze here lately, trying to break these banks? Have you been following that at all?
So. Based on what I saw on GameStop, I have no interest in the. I mean, here's the thing: if you look at the big precious metals positions, right now we're going through a process where all the smart money is trying to buy silver and gold, and interest everybody, you know, get all the retail guys to buy crypto so that we can keep them away. You know, if we're going to try and corner the farmland and we're going to try and corner all the gold bullion, the last thing we need is retail coming in and competing with us and driving the prices up. So if you're the central bankers and you want to keep the price of gold down, one, so the smart money can accumulate it, but two, so that nobody, you know, it's like the smoke alarm. You don't want the smoke alarm to go up too much. You get everybody over here busy in crypto. Now, if you look traditionally at the big positions in precious metals, you know, I would describe those as being backed up by the Exchange Stabilization Fund and the U.S. Treasury. So the idea that you're going to squeeze the banks and bring this position down says to me you have no idea what position you're up against. Somebody once asked, when J.P. Morgan Chase had huge derivative positions in the precious metals market, I asked the head of their commodities entity, you know, what their positions were, and she said all their positions were as agents, which means they're not the principal. So, you know, I don't know about you, but I never like trading against a nuclear arsenal.
Wow. I mean, basically, you're up against a blank check by the federal government. You can't, there's no way you can out-squeeze them.
You're up against a blank check by the owners of the central banks. So
even
if you've
worse.
Ever seen Game of Thrones, you're trying to out-trade the Iron Bank, and that's probably not, you know, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, it's a speculation, but it says to me you don't understand the game you're in.
Well, here, okay, but I can see the physical silver, if everybody goes, if everybody in America, 3% of America went to their coin store and bought a silver coin, now you do have a problem because there is only so much physical silver in the world.
Right. And when they go buy some silver, I suggest they go buy some farmland.
Wow. Wow.
Because all right, the big danger here is not that they're going to corner precious metals. The big danger here is, you know, Bill Gates is now the largest farmland owner in America.
Yeah, I noticed
and,
that.
And, you know, he's making big, big bets on plant and synthetic food. You know, we just did the first insect factory opening up, if I read the headline right. So what I'm telling you is, you know, the number one question is, you're not going to be able to eat your crypto, and you're probably not going to be able to eat your silver. And the question is, where is your fresh food going to come from? That's the thing I would most worry about.
All right, let me ask you before we get into solutions. This interview is good. I can sit here. I'm just fascinated listening to you. We only got about probably 20 minutes left in this interview. We got to talk about solutions and this question here. You've already mentioned this several times. People for years thought, well, I don't care about politics. I can just live my life as long as I can just, you know, I can still eat and go on vacation, whatever, I'm fine. There's some degree of separation between this ugly part of America and Main Street America that's starting to disappear. This concept of American dollars as the reserve currency, this is going away, going into something else. We can all see this. We obviously just saw a stolen election into, for whatever that means, we see this virus come out of nowhere, conveniently solves all these problems for these wannabe controllers. I mean, if that's what we're dealing with, this is perfect for them. Please seamlessly take us from dollar reserve no more to this new system, virus lockdown, in 15 minutes. Let's see what you can do, Catherine.
So here's the important question. The place the rubber is going to meet the road this year is on your taxes. So if you're paying taxes to a jurisdiction and that jurisdiction is using that money in a way that is outside the law, that's a problem, particularly if spending the money outside the law hurts you.
What do you mean? What do you mean by that? You mean to the U.S. corporation? What do you mean?
So let me give you an example. If I'm living in Flint, Michigan, and I pay taxes to the local county and state authorities, but they don't take a proper care of my water system, you know, I could end up poisoned. Right?
Right.
If I'm paying taxes, but the money is not being spent to properly manage the responsibilities, then under the Constitution, I'm responsible. Right? So while everybody's been entertained by the presidential campaign, they haven't been paying attention to who's the sheriff, what's the local budget, where's the money going? You know, so why is your state or county using as their depository banks that did the, you know, the bailouts and all the financial shenanigans? Okay. So, physician heal thyself. In South America, when things imploded in the early 2000s, the Brazilians in Porto Alegre got together in something called participatory budgeting. Everybody got in and said, okay, you guys aren't going to make the budget anymore. We, the citizens, are going to participate. Now, what you'll discover is if you'll participate in the budget, if you'll take the time, instead of paying attention to the stupid, you know, shriek-a-meter about presidential campaigns, if you'll take the time to learn how the money works around you on your tax money, whether it's federal, state, or local, what you'll discover is there are fantastic opportunities to re-engineer how the money works out of doing things which are lawless and back into doing things which are not only lawful, but they create employment locally or they create more income for the small business. I mean, the small business has allowed corporations to take away huge amount of market share before they played this essential, non-essential game, you know, and they've done it because they weren't paying attention to how the government money works. And so if you will get together,
give us an
example
of how they use our money against us to basically cut our heads off.
Right. So let's take HUD, where I used to work. When I first got there as Assistant Secretary of Housing in 1989, I did an analysis, and what I discovered on some of the subsidy programs, when they first started, 70 to 80% of that money was going into the local community. By the time I got there, I estimated it was 29%. It was all going into very, very expensive intermediaries. So we would see situations where we were spending $250,000 per unit to rehab or construct public housing, when in the FHA portfolio, for that amount of money, I could buy and rehab 5 or 4 FHA defaulted single family homes. So I'm getting one home for the price of 4 or 5, right? And I tried to change the rules so that I could re-optimize by place. No, not allowed. Anyway, but imagine being a group of citizens who walk in with the financial disclosure and say, you are spending, we could get 5 homes for the price of 1. Why are you doing that? I took the numbers. I found all these neighborhoods. One was New Orleans. One was Chicago. There was another one. I think it might be in the Hillary thing. And I took, we were doing the due diligence as financial advisor for HUD, we found all these neighborhoods where the public housing guys were spending $250,000 per unit for the HOPE program. And, we could get 4 or 5 homes, single family homes, out of the FHA foreclosure, rehabbed and, cleaned up. So I took it to the woman who was the assistant to the head of the HOPE program at public housing, and I showed it to her. She got really angry, turned bright red, and she said, but how would we generate fees for our friends? I said, Mindy, just give your friends $50,000, take the other $200,000, we can do 4 homes. You can put money in your friend's pocket. We don't have to, it's very expensive to put fees in your friend's pocket this way. Anyway, but we've had, as far as I'm concerned,
but it's legal, Catherine, but it's legal this way.
Well, here's the thing. I would disagree with that. And I'll tell you why. There's a lot of great financial management law. If you go to missingmoney.solari.com and click on the legal section, I had 2 of my attorneys map out all the fiscal and monetary law and authorities, and the law is very, very good. And if you apply that law, no, you can't just spend, 5 times what you need to get one thing and think that's all going to be kosher. Now, we're in a country right now, the United States is a country right now where you have everybody saying that whatever they want to do is legal and pretending that it's so, but that doesn't make it so. Just because I don't have $5 million to litigate with you about it doesn't make it true. So anyway, so let me give you one other example. I have never seen a neighborhood when I drilled down into the money where I couldn't find a corporate contractor in Washington being paid $100 an hour to do something, that somebody in that neighborhood would love to do for $25 plus healthcare. When I first got to, I live in Hickory Valley, Tennessee. When I first got there, we discovered, we could take 2 local entrepreneurs. They'd start a waste management little service. They pick up our garbage instead of getting the corporate guy to do. We fired the corporate guy and turned it over to entrepreneurs in our neighborhood, and we cut the bill 50%. So you want to look at how the money works on corporate contractors. I could walk you through the food stamp program some other time. It's a much longer conversation. But basically, there's a great story that got me going on this where one woman in Florida who couldn't find a job during the financial crisis picked up the phone. She had to get food stamps just to eat. And she picked up the phone and found herself talking to somebody in tech support in India working for JP Morgan Chase, doing a job she'd love to do. And if she could do it, then she wouldn't need food stamps or government subsidy. So we're paying people in America to not work. At the same time, we're outsourcing their jobs. But JP Morgan Chase is getting a markup. I don't mean to pick on them, but obviously I believe they deserve it. So there, if you look at the arbitrage, so I'll give you another example. The New York Fed member banks pay 0 to 1% to borrow money, but the average American on their credit card pays 16 to 17%. Well, I got news for you. Why are we investing in them when we can simply refinance each other and you know, make more money and save, you know, instead of paying 16 to 17%, maybe we can pay 5 to 10%, and our neighbor can get a higher yield on, and you know, so there are millions of opportunities, but you're going to have to do the hard work, or somebody is, of looking at how the money works around you, whether the government money or the financial flows, and start to find the opportunities. They're there.
Where we have about 10 minutes left. Where does the COVID come into all this? Obviously, you sound a lot like Klaus Schwab, or what he's laying out, this great reset. That's what you're kind of talking about.
No. Schwab is totally separate from the central bankers. And I would describe Schwab as essentially a distraction. The going direct reset was voted on by the G7 central bankers at Jackson Hole, Wyoming. That is the real reset.
Well, explain that. Okay, explain the difference.
Here's the thing. This is not something I can do in, you know, two sentences. Yeah, we just published a great wrap up called The Going Direct Reset by John Titus. And it is a serious look about what we know about the Great Reset, which was designed by a group of retired central bankers working through the BlackRock Investment Institute. BlackRock is one of the largest asset managers in the country and has been doing a lot of the programs for the Fed and, you know, from what it looks like, has been essentially designing the sort of the reengineering of the financial system. And their people from BlackRock are going in and taking a lot of important positions in the U.S. government, including, I think, Yellen's deputy is Larry Fink, who's the CEO of BlackRock's old chief of staff. So, you know, the question is BlackRock running the government? You know, question mark.
What does it look like if they're successful on the other side, and what in the world does COVID have to do with it?
You know, to talk about COVID, you need somebody from the medical side. The reality is, if you look at the statistics of what we know about COVID so far, there's no reason that I can understand, or any of the doctors I listen to can understand, why you would engage in this kind of economic warfare. So what I see is a healthcare crisis is being used to shut down Main Street businesses. Anybody who's an independent producer is being destroyed to try and ultimately, I think, get them to be financially dependent. So to me, this looks like an effort for all the non-publicly traded businesses to lose their market share to the companies that are publicly traded, thus driving their stocks up, and thus providing the resources for a lot more political campaign contributions.
Oh, jeez. Where's transhumanism come in into this? You talk about this a lot on your Planet Lockdown interview.
So I think, you know, I'm a big believer in scenario design. Are you familiar with scenario design?
A little bit, yeah.
So we have, every year for our wrap-up, we do scenario planning, and we create four scenarios. You take two variables and create a vertical and horizontal axis, and that creates four quadrants with four scenarios. And what we like to do is have one quadrant that's culture and one quadrant that's finance. And the finance one goes from they print to we print, which is we continue to concede a monopoly on the control of the creation of currency and money, or we decide, no, we're going to start doing community currencies and other things that create liquidity at the local or network level so that, you know, a few people don't control a monopoly on, sponsored of our currencies. So that's one. That's the horizontal axis in the last wrap-up. And then we have another called culture, and one at the top is human, and the other is inhuman. And everybody wow. should say, inhuman is not a word. I said, no, but it is a phenomena. and, you know, the appropriate word for that is really transhumanism, which is, so the human vision that you and I have lived with is the notion that we are sovereign individuals whose freedom comes to us by divine authority. And our connection, our sovereign connection is between us and the divine. And the transhumanist vision, basically, I would describe as we're a resource like an oil deposit to be used as such. And one of the people who's done a fantastic job of describing this is Patrick Wood and his books on technocracy. Because if you look at how this is being implemented, it's a very complex system, but once you work through it, you know, Patrick's done a great job of unpacking it. And part of this is, you know, the biotech revolution is allowing you to do things that are so gruesome and so sneaky and so invisible. I mean, you read some of this stuff and you just think, you can't make this up. You know, why would anybody want to do that? And I think it's hard for most people to realize that anybody would want to do this stuff. Because it's hard for people who are capable of empathy to envision a group of people who don't have empathy. What I will tell you is that if you look at the potential of this technology, you know, and this is what I said in Planet Lockdown, my analysis of the history of investment is the slave trade has always been, slavery is the most profitable business historically, more profiting than mining, more profitable than addiction. And this essentially allows you to take the human race into slavery. And the question is, can you do it with sufficient, mechanisms to get them to not sort of see what's happening before you throw the trap door?
Do you think they will be able to? I mean, where do you think this fight will go? Do you think we'll wake up in time?
I think it will fail because it's out of alignment with life. And I think love and the divine intelligence is the most powerful force in the universe. So I think it will fail. I don't underestimate the pain and harm that can occur. I mean, look at the pain and harm that's occurred over the last, since the Going Direct reset was voted on. I mean, it's kind of astonishing. How do you go into a room with a small group of central bankers and vote on something that is the financial equivalent of dropping a nuclear bomb on the planet? How do you do that?
This whole thing is stunning and maddening at the same time. We have just a few minutes left. It's been an absolute pleasure. We're talking to Catherine Olson at Solari.com.
Can I just say one more thing?
You can
I'm
do
gonna
anything.
Be a real
you
bad
want,
guy. I'm going to be the hard person here. You know, I used to have a wonderful pastor in Washington and say, if we can face it, God can fix it.
Ooh,
and there have been many brave, courageous souls for the last 25 years trying to get the American people to face the red button problem and to do what they could to fix it. And, you know, I'll be a tough guy. We prefer to have a party. So here we are now. And if you want to get power over this, the way you get power over any problem is you take responsibility for it. You say, I'm a citizen under the Constitution. This is my problem. I'm going to take responsibility and try and bring, you know, the flows of time and money back into the law. And it's going to start by, we have an article up at Solari called Coming Clean. You know, I'm going to start by coming clean. I'm going to go through my bank accounts and my investments and my purchases, and I'm going to get these guys out of my life. I'm going to get them out of my mind. If you're watching TV, you're the problem. I mean, why are you watching that stuff?
Just continue on with solutions. We've got 2 minutes. Solari.com is our website. Catherine Olson Fitz. Just continue until we got to go. I mean, this is fantastic.
One of the – So one of the things that really shocked me in the last week, and I'm, as you can probably tell, I'm hard to shock, it was the cancellation of the Bruce Springsteen ad by Jeep. Did you see it? Speaking of watching TV, I don't own a TV, but I don't know if you saw it. It was beautiful.
You're talking about the Super Bowl commercial?
Yeah.
Yeah, I will never buy a Jeep ever. I will never buy a Jeep ever.
Well, but I, you know, here's the credit to the people at Jeep that they ran it, because you can tell they didn't realize our number one story in the 2020 annual wrap-up. You know, I do this roundup with Dr. Farrell every year. Our number one story in the economic section was the war on God. And apparently the people at Jeep and Bruce Springsteen did not understand that there is a war on God, and they got, you know, they got crosswise in that war and got their head handed to them. And if there was ever proof that the number one story for 2020 was the war on God, there it is.
Mm. Do you think there's enough moral fiber, moral connection? I mean, America is the last stand here for the worldwide, you know, liberty, it seems like to me. Is there enough moral fiber in America to pick ourselves up without near destruction to do this? As you say, you know, obviously the universe is concerned about life.
There's a lot of freedom-loving people all over the world.
True, no question.
I mean, and this is going to have to be global. You know, freedom is going to have to be, because all the solutions require global solutions. The question in any system is who enforces. So if the pro-centralization team is going to have a complete totalitarian controlled system, you know, then that's going to be the, you know, it's going to be global totalitarianism. If we're going to have freedom, then we have to come up with something where 8 billion people take responsibility, you know, to be lawful and to help their local systems remain lawful. And that's the question. Can we step up and take responsibility? Now, everybody doesn't have to be a leader in that. We need a small group of people to lead it. But, you know, these guys have been able to do this for many, many decades because we were happy to not push the red button. So, you know, the funny thing is we refused to push the red button for, you know, 50, 60 years. And now Mr. Global has pushed the red button.
And, you know, boy, isn't that... Yeah, it's on their terms. We didn't push it on our terms. They pushed it on their terms. Catherine, also, it's been a pleasure. Stay right there, Catherine. Solari.com. Ladies and gentlemen, have a great weekend. Happy, healthy, successful, and free as God intends you. The Power, you're listening to The Power Hour. We'll see you next week.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.